Welcome to CL Talk, the leading podcast for the legal profession across Canada, brought to you by Canadian Lawyer Magazine. For today's episode of CL Talk, I'm honored to welcome Jordan Furlong, a strategic consultant to legal organizations in Canada and the United States. After being called to the bar in Ontario, Jordan worked as a legal journalist in Canada at the Lawyers Weekly and with the Canadian Bar Association, until he launched his blog Law 21 in 2007. In 2017, he published the book Law is a Buyer's Market, Building a Client-First Law Firm, and he has also worked as an independent consultant, author, and speaker. Many of our listeners will know Jordan from his prolific writing. Most recently, Jordan launched a Substack newsletter under his name. Welcome, Jordan.
Thank you very much, Tim. It's fantastic to be here.
So today, we're going to talk about a lot of topics. You've covered many timely topics for lawyers that you know are in the zeitgeist. But I noticed in some of your writing that you've said that you used to talk about the future, but you're done talking about the future. Can you tell me a bit about why you said that?
Yeah, and I think it was really the advent of the pandemic and then everything that flowed from that, not just in terms of social change, but also in professional change in where how legal work is done, how law offices are constituted, the rise of artificial intelligence. And what I said to people was, the future's here now, right? You know, there's no point talking about what's going to come. We got our hands full right now with the present. And that's the spirit in which I'm kind of approaching all the crazy stuff going on right now.
Great. Well, let's dive right in. We can talk a bit about your work as well, but I want to start off with what everyone's talking about, AI. And just tell me what your view is on the role of AI in legal services.
Yeah. So generative AI is, at the best of times, it's a very rapidly moving target. Discussion you can have about Gen AI today will be different from the one we had 4 or 5 months ago. And we talked again in 9 or 10 months and we could be in a different world altogether. So The number one thing I sort of say to lawyers is nobody entirely understands yet what we have on our hands here and what this is fully capable of doing. We got a pretty good sense of what it can already do, and what it can already do is pretty impressive. How far it's going to go down the road, not sure. And so I tend to be relatively conservative in my predictions around generative AI, not because I don't think it's very powerful technology. I do. I actually think it is game-changing for the legal services sector, but because it's very easy to over-predict and to overstate. We're probably heading into, we are just kind of coming to the end of the really intense hype cycle around generative AI right now. We're probably looking at a little bit of a crash in terms of disappointment as like, oh, I thought it was going to be bigger than this. And then it will slowly pick up after that. What I can say to lawyers at this point is that generative AI has two dimensions to it, which I think are really important for the legal profession. The first is its ability to generate content at an extraordinarily streamlined, rapid, and really proficient pace. You can give it some instructions and it will render you paragraphs and pages of material, and it's really good. It is, you can use it to draft messages. You can use it to do the first draft of a factum, or use it to review documents and almost do a bit of a red line and so forth. It has an amazing capacity to do the kind of work that articling students, first, second, even third or fourth year students, lawyers, have been doing for quite some time. The main implications on this dimension, of course, is intense acceleration of efficiency. It's going to take a lot less time to do the work that we normally did as lawyers in the past. That's going to have an impact on the business model, which we can talk about a little bit later on. It's also going to have an impact on what lawyers are going to do early in their careers. So, and that's where most of the focus tends to be on, oh my gosh, this is going to be, you know, it's going to take away all my work. But the other dimension of it, which I think is actually more interesting and more powerful, is the creative dimension. It is a remarkable, you can think of it almost as a creative intern, someone who works with you and helps you bounce ideas off them or try things out, or you know, give me a sketch of what this might look like. What are 5 ideas that we could use in this situation? What are 3 strategies we could adopt? And that could be for client work if you're very careful about to maintain your confidentiality. But it's also terrific for your own business and your own work and managing your own people and planning your own business forward. So it really is almost like having a very knowledgeable, hardworking intern who doesn't know much about the real world and is very morally ambiguous. It's important to understand that, working for you pretty much free if you wanted to. You can buy the $20 US a month version from OpenAI, as I do, or you can just go to the one that Microsoft Bing has one installed in their browser and use that one there. But the one thing that my takeaway for lawyers on all this is just go out and use it. Play with it. See what it can do. See what it can't do. You will be surprised at the applications you can find for your work, and then start thinking about what that will mean for your business as a lawyer.
So you touched on this. So AI is just one tool, I guess, but some of the things you talked about, how it can be used or should be used, gets to sort of more fundamental questions about the legal profession and the business model. So you've said things, you know, maybe big statements about how the legal profession has to change. Can you tell me a bit about what your current view is on how law firms operate as a business and where you think they need to be or where they're actually changing now? And, you know, as not just, as you said, looking to the future, but looking at what's happening now.
Well, credit where it's due. In the last 20 years, let's say, because I've been watching law firms for at least that amount of time. Over that period of time, I have seen law firm business models, operations, finances, management, all pretty much all the elements of how law firms work improve significantly in terms of sophistication, in terms of resources devoted to the professional business management of these entities. And this is as true for these massive 100, 500,000 lawyer law firms, which are just like sprawling factories of knowledge production, as it is for solo and small firm lawyers and law firms. And a lot of this comes down to the explosion of legal and accessible legal technology. If you're a small firm lawyer and you're not using Clio or a similar online practice management program, I haven't met you yet because I don't think you exist. So with that in mind, that we have come a long way, I do still think we have a long way to go. The vulnerability at the heart of the traditional law firm business model, at least when you get past it, if you're solo, working by yourself, for yourself, okay, that's a different conversation. But if you have even one or two associates working for you or other lawyers who are not equity-owning partners, then you rely to a certain extent on leverage, right? You are paying your associates a certain amount of money and you're billing them out at a higher rate than that because you know that you can get lots and lots of hours to work on. First of all, generative AI is going to swoop in and it's going to gobble up a lot of those hours. Secondly, it is getting more and more difficult to convince associates that it's worth their while to power through years and years of very straightforward and, let's face it, not very interesting work just so they can pay their dues and generate billable income for you. You throw into this all the issues around remote work and hybrid work, and you really get to the point where a law firm whose business model is premised on the idea of, I will spend a lot of time doing a lot of hard work for my clients and I will bill to them an amount equal to the amount of time that I have billed on this, I just don't see it as sustainable. This isn't about the billable hour per se. That's a separate conversation. This is more about the idea of what is the value you're providing to your clients and to businesses. So we need to have new conversations now. We need to talk about pricing, not according to the amount of time it takes you to do work, perhaps not even according to the value, because again, we can have a conversation about the billable hour, but value is a very difficult thing to nail down. But almost about the relationship that you have with your client or simply what the market's willing to bear. It's going to have to be more packaged pricing. It's got to be more retainer pricing, perhaps monthly, quarterly, annual, client-based, who knows. And then we don't have time, of course, to dig into all the other ways in which law firms do need to improve. We can have a whole conversation about the management of people, especially of younger lawyers, but also with staff members. So I do want to give credit. We have come a long way. But there's so much more to do. In so many respects, law firms are still well behind the curve in terms of how even other professional businesses are running. And it does not take that long to find good resources. There's lots of them out there. And there's lots of people who are willing to help you with it. But as a lawyer, you just need to make the commitment to say, I am going to carve out the time and effort to pay attention, not just to work in my business, but to work on my business.
Great. And you mentioned the billable hour, and I want to get into that now a little bit more detail. So I think a lot of the things you've written about and other sort of people who predict changes in the legal profession, as you said, have started happening. But arguably, the billable hour has not moved much in terms of how many firms have moved to other forms of billing, as you mentioned. Why is that? And do you think, you think of yourself, you've been in the talking about the legal profession for a few decades now. Were you predicting its demise? And if you were, why do you think it's still stuck around? And where is it going in that for that, something that's been hard pressed to change?
I absolutely predicted the death of the billable hour. There was an entire cover story at National Magazine of the CBA a few years into my tenure as editor there called Time's Up, Why the Billable Hour is Finished and so forth. And I was not the first and not the last to write the obituary of the billable hour, and it has outlived all of us. My position on it now is that it will survive until shortly after the sun goes NOVA. There is, I am no longer in the business of predicting its end. I am in the business, however, of trying to figure out why it is so resilient and to figure out what it, because it isn't just because it's convenient and profitable for lawyers, which it absolutely is. But if that's all it were, then clients individually and en masse would have rebelled against it ages ago. And all the efforts that have been made, and really good efforts in terms of developing much more sophisticated pricing mechanisms and fixed prices and fixed fees, would have succeeded, and they have not. In fact, when I talk to innovators within law firms on around pricing, they often shrug and say it's the clients who say what they want to stick with the billable hour. They don't really want to try these new efforts. And it's funny, I sort of say to them, well, why is that? Why don't they want to try your alternative fees? They say because they don't trust us, and they assume that if we're trying to get a new pricing mechanism in, it's because we're trying to make more money off them. And I said, okay, I think you don't have a pricing problem. You have a different problem. But I have tried, I think, to understand the billable hour a little bit better, and I think this is where I've come to. The billable hour works in a very pragmatic fashion, essentially because it's a proxy for the value exchange between the lawyer and the client. Because many people and very smart and forward-thinking value pricing advocates will say it's all about determining the value to the client. And I've come to kind of conclude on this, but the client doesn't know, right? In most cases, a client doesn't have a clue how much the lawyer's work is worth. Okay, if you're suing someone for $1 million, okay, I guess that's a $1 million deal, or if that's how much the M&A transaction you're closing is worth. But for the most part, what's it worth to get a will made out? What's it worth to get entry into Canada as an immigrant? What's it worth to be convicted of a crime for 2 years less a day, not 2 years more a day? You cannot possibly put a number on that. And the lawyers don't know. We don't have a clue. We have no training in this kind of thing. So when both lawyers and clients don't know how much something is worth, you got to find something to do it and to work with it. And the billable hour is, it's so easy, right? Because it correlates with our general sense that the harder and longer you work at something, the more you should get paid for it. And that's something that goes back. That's pre-industrial revolution days. And I really think that that's why it has survived as long as it has. And you know what? It's kind of hard to find fault with that or to argue with it. So the billable hour as a pricing mechanism, in a way, I sort of come to kind of a truce with it. I say, if you can find a better system where you can price work in a different way, as I sort of mentioned before, I think you should, because you're going to make a lot more money off it and you're going to cover off your vulnerability. My remaining issue with the billable hour is in terms of compensation and lawyer assessment and billable hour targets. And this gets back to management in law firms. I think that because we have made, especially in law firms with a number of associates, even a number of partners, a fetish out of you must hit a high number of billable hour targets every year. We have built so many bad habits. We have discouraged innovation. We have deeply, severely compromised the mental and physical and emotional health of lawyers. And all to chase, you're chasing the setting sun, right? You're always looking for more and more. I wrote a tongue-in-cheek piece a few years back called How to Make Less Money as a Law Firm. And one of the ways in which you do is to put a cap on the number of billable hours you will compensate people for. So to say, okay, you want to build 3,000 hours a year, fill your boots, but we're not paying you for anything, not even a bonus past 1,500. And that's kind of where it comes down to for me. How are you treating? How are you incentivizing? How are you rewarding your employees? What kind of behaviors do you want from them? Because if all you want your lawyers to do is to go get work and go to bill work, and it seems to me that that's what most law firm compensation systems are about, then that's all they'll do. You'll get what you pay for. So I think trying to diversify your operations in this way is very much the way I would encourage people to think. think about different ways to incentivize and compensate and reward your people.
Great. And so the billable hour, and at least in my mind, sounds like you agree, is one of the things that hasn't changed radically where we may have thought it would. And then on the other extreme, I would argue, you know, there's some things that have changed very quickly, it seems to me, in the law firm culture. So we could talk about a lot of these things. But one of the things that I've found most recently seems like a, you know, if you're cynical, is a big buzzword. This year has been mental health. And mm-hmm. you're the end of your answer to the last question, sort of about the culture at firms, you know, touches on this. So what do you think about, you know, what has actually changed, or is it just buzzwords, and what actually should change how law firms operate to better address the mental health of especially younger lawyers there?
Yeah. No, it's not buzzwords. It is a serious problem. And we're seeing more of it for a couple of reasons. One, some, not all, of the stigma of admitting to the fact that you are unwell mentally or emotionally or physically because of, or at least primarily because of, your work as a lawyer. Some of that stigma is starting to ease, I think, especially amongst younger lawyers. For the older ones, it's still more of a taboo subject, especially when we talk about substance addiction. So that's one reason. But the other reason, not just that people are more comfortable talking about it and reporting it, but there's a lot more of it. And once again, you will find this the case for younger lawyers. And when I have conversations with older practitioners, I have to remind them sometimes. I said, look, I graduated from law school in 1993, and tuition in my final year was $2,100. And today it's going to be minimum 10 times that in most places. So I came out with a level of debt that I could pay off and did pay off in the course of about 6 or 7 years. These people are going to be carrying this for decades, and the pressure that places on them is extraordinary. And that's just one of the sources of pressure that they're under. We talk about the billable hour targets. We talk about the demands. We talk about the fact that law firms are not what you would call emotionally safe spaces. I know older lawyers will kind of roll their eyes at that a little bit and what have you, but we can have a separate conversation about the generational side of things. There's an old saying, as I'm sure you know, there are two kinds of people in the world. There are those who go through something terrible and say, no one else should ever have to go through that. And there are people who say, you know, they go through something terrible, and so everybody else has to go through it too. And to the extent that that second group is in charge of your law firm's in trouble. The unwellness of people, and there's lots of reasons for it. It's not just because law is a punishing profession. It's supposed to be stressful. It's supposed to be difficult, right? If you're living a completely stress-free life as a lawyer, I think you're doing something wrong. But there's ordinary pressure, and then there's what is crushing people today, and especially younger people today, and driving them out of the profession, never to return. How do we cope with that? My advice to the regulators on this point has been, number one, you've got to prepare people much better for the practice of law. And that means not just, and this is a conversation, we don't have time for this one, but a complete revamp of the education, training, licensing process for lawyers, which is simply inadequate to the challenge that practicing law creates today, but also to warn them. You've got to tell people coming in, you are heading into a blizzard and it's tough in there, and you got to be ready for it as much as possible. And here are resources and here's materials, and it's okay to feel the way you feel about things, right? You look at that survey that the CBA and the Federation of Law Societies jointly did a year or so ago. And the numbers that they found in Canada, which reflect the numbers elsewhere, the one that I will never forget is 24% of lawyers surveyed have at least once in their careers thought about killing themselves. And, you know, and that goes beyond red flags. That goes beyond a red alert. This is not an approaching problem. This is a crisis full blown that we're in right now. And I would love us as a profession to down tools and fix that first, because unless we're well, unless we're not desperately sick, we cannot be the people we're supposed to be and fulfill the roles we're supposed to fulfill.
That's great. There's a lot to think about. You've written about a lot of other, you know, big picture questions for the legal profession. We don't have time to get into all of them. So I'll just give our listeners some examples. You've written about self-regulation. You've already, you talked a little bit about this already, the legal education. And you're working as a consultant as well. You publish this information on your Substack, on your blog before. But you're also, I think, being retained by law firms and doing other kinds of work. So I have just a question about your impression now. You started in Canada, but I know you do a lot of work in the US as well. You speak to a lot of US lawyers. What's your impression right now of the Canadian legal market with your global perspective, more than, you know, the average Canadian lawyer? Where do you see Canada? Is it unique, or is it suffering from the same issues or evolving in the same way that other markets are?
Yeah, I would say the Canadian market is writ very largely, obviously, right? You know, this is a vastly multidimensional concept. But the Canadian market, generally speaking, is in the same place and proceeding at the same pace for the most part as other Western common law countries, you know, Australia, New Zealand, and England, Wales, and Scotland, and those places. Europe is its own world, and each European country is its own world. Spain is not France, is not Germany. I do find that, speaking broadly, the European nations tend to be farther behind in terms of openness to innovation, change, practice, gender issues in the law, and so forth. In my limited exposure to South America, I think they're actually a little more new world oriented than Europe. But I'd say Canada probably tracks relatively close to the U.S. We tend to be about 2 or 3 years behind them in everything, right? In politics, in lots of different trends. I would say that for the most part, Canada is probably, if you offered me a choice to practice law in the U.S. or practice law in Canada, I would practice law in Canada, not just because I love living here, but because I think the firms are more sensibly run and humanely run as a general rule. I don't want to insult any of my American client friends, but when I talk to the firms in Canada, the kind of stuff they're doing for their lawyers and their staff, and I have the similar conversation in the U.S., it's just a different cultural feeling. Canada is a country where I think we tend to prioritize taking care of each other. And the United States is a country people tend to prioritize, you know, you're on your own and you got to make it in the world on your own. And there's pros and cons to that. I'm not saying, you know, either is better or worse than the other. I would like to see more, I guess the best word I can come up with is ambition from Canadian firms. I think there is a level of complacency here, which concerns me. Sort of say, well, you know, everything's probably going to work out okay. Things aren't that difficult or that bad. I don't take the AI stuff that seriously. And, you know, and all the stuff about wellness is just wokeness and this kind of nonsense. And I worry about that because we are already at a very challenging time, and it's going to get rough next year and the year after that. There are storms coming our way. And I'm writing about this now on my Substack, and I've got a big piece coming up about it next week. And I want to warn against complacency. I want people to say, you're going to have to get all hands on deck pretty soon and take seriously. We're looking at some pretty, not just fundamental, maybe even existential issues for law firms and the legal sector these days and the legal profession. And so please think beyond the next quarter. Think beyond the profit for partners. Think about your role as a legal professional, your law firm's place as a pillar in the community. And yeah, it's an extraordinary time we're in right now. A lot of challenges, but a ton of opportunities as well. And that's really the message I'd like to send to the Canadian legal profession right now.
Well, that's great. That was a great way to end the discussion. We just touched on so many of these issues. I could just keep going for hours, but our listeners are busy people and they have their firms and they need to deal with these issues that you're talking about and actually get into the weeds and start innovating. So thank you so much, Jordan, for your time. For our listeners, as I said, you can read more of Jordan's insights in his Substack newsletter. Jordan's based in Ottawa, so if you are there, you can also see him in person. And I know you travel a lot as well, Jordan. So best of luck with all your work in the legal profession. We'll all be excited to hear more of your insights about all the big picture topics that our law firms are grappling with across the world. Thank you again, and it was great speaking with you, and we'll hope to hear from you soon again.
Thank you very much, Tim. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you for tuning in to CL Talk. You can listen to the latest episodes on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, and all major listening channels. Just search for CL Talk.